quorum present, that being Senators Donnelly, Senator Torgerson, and myself, Senator Taylor, Chair. The matter before us today is a bill brought by Senator Donnelly that's entitled An Act Relating to the Adoption Amendment Repeal Legislative Review and Judicial Review of Regulations. The number of the bill is 24, Senate Bill Number 24. Senator Donnelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this is legislation that I've had in one form or another before the legislature for, I think, 6 to 8 years now. Current system of regulation in Alaska is very, very important. We, as legislature, adopt statutes, and then we authorize departments to adopt regulations to implement those statutes under the Administrative Procedures Act. Since statehood, those regulations now constitute 8 volumes of this size, or administrative procedures, administrative codes in the state of Alaska, all of which have the same effect as statutes. As if the legislature had adopted each one of these, and the legislature doesn't have the power to even amend or repeal any of these regulations. They're there until we actually pass a state law that would somehow conflict with them and make them no longer applicable, which, as you know, would be subject to a governor's veto. And so since the governor supposedly supports all these regulations, since it's his bureaucracy to put them there, it's very unlikely we'd have much of a chance to undo any of them without a two-thirds vote. But the procedure by which they're adopted in no way mirrors the process, the public process we go through in the legislature for adopting statutes. The administrative code simply requires that a department that wants to adopt a regulation, which once again has the effect of law, just like a statute, puts out a notice to the public saying that we're thinking about adopting a regulation that deals with such and such. Sometimes they'll say, we think this is what we want to do. They take public comment, they consider it, and then they can come back and adopt something that's, frankly, substantially different than what they initially put out the comment on. And the public wouldn't know what exactly to expect, and that now becomes the law of the land, which is very different, of course, from the legislative process, where as we go through the process here, the public sees multiple steps of the statutes as they're adopted, as they go through each committee and are dealt with by one body and then the other body. And even if a second body changes it, the public sees exactly what the new change is, and then that would go back to the House or the Senate to be confirmed, and they'd know exactly what that was. And the public would see the steps all the way through, and there's no way it can become law unless that last step is available to the public before the House or the Senate takes that final vote on it. And frankly, then most of those, other than resolutions, would then go to the governor, and the public once again gets to see the final work product before they get to express their opinion to the governor about whether it should become law or not. All those steps aren't reflected in these 8 volumes. These are adopted with just that one notice, initial notice, and then subsequently they can pretty much do what they want. There are guidelines in the Administrative Procedure Act for that. Over the years, of course, we've heard a lot from constituents that there's just too many of these things. There's too much of it. It's overwhelming trying to deal with it. I guess as society becomes more and more complex, becomes more and more difficult for a part-time citizen legislature to address every possible issue that a bureaucracy would want to address, and it is appropriate to have them have regulatory power. But the concern becomes that without this open process that went into the statutory basis for these, this code can now be contrary to even what the statutes originally intended and can be much more complex and more onerous on the public than the public would ever have allowed a statute to become, because our process is much more open than the process that went into developing those. accordingly, I've tried to address this by just a few simple revisions in how regulations are adopted. This law would say that for most regulations, with the exception of a few that are directly listed here, the Board of Fish, Board of Game, Limited Entry Commission, and Department of Corrections, for most of them, things would work kind of the way they currently work. Bureaucracy wants to adopt a regulation, or they're required to do so. They'd issue a notice to the public of what that regulation would entail and tell the public of what they think the content of it would be or how it, what form it would take. And then after public hearing, if they wanted to do that the way they had explained it, they could go ahead and do it. But if they were going to substantially change what they had initially proposed, then they would have to reissue it and tell the public what they intended to do now. So the public would have the opportunity to see what the final version would look like and comment on the final version rather than speculate on something that you really can't tell what they're going to do from the first notice. So if things did change, then the public would simply get notice of what the new changes were so they could subsequently comment on those to have a much more open public process that way. Additionally, the bill calls for that, along with the other things the Administrative Procedure Act calls for the adoption of a new regulation, that the department would do a summary of cost-benefit analysis and issue that along with the proposed adoption of the regulation. Frequently, it's hard to measure whether these ideas are maybe they're more trouble than they're worth. It seems like a very positive, minimal thing to ask a bureaucracy to do is to do a cost-benefit analysis and see if these new laws, because that's what regulations are, they're simply new laws, are really worth the trouble they're going to cost. They ought to be able to make that case. I mean, we have to make that case in every committee meeting we go to on a new proposal here pretty thoroughly. Case that they're worth making the change. It's going to be more of a benefit than any detriment that might come. So it would require that. And the committee substitute that I've put forward does make exceptions for all emergency regulations, for any mandates from the federal government, so that something that's out of the department's control, they have to do it to comply with the federal law. And that's pretty much what the bill does in a summary form. There's a sectional analysis that's included that's much more specific. Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to give like an overview of the concept of what's going on here. There is a CS that I strongly support and hope the committee would go ahead and adopt. It removes some of the concerns from the court system, the original bill, trying to add public access to the regulatory process. Currently, to challenge regulation, you have to go to Superior Court. You can't do that in district court. And as you know, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot more district courts available to the public in more geographic areas of Alaska than there are Superior Courts, and it costs less to get into district court than Superior Court. I would prefer that, you know, that barrier not be there. But I understand the court system's concerned about that and has raised objections to it. That seems surprising to me that someone who's a district court judge couldn't deal with administrative law, because it's not rocket science. I mean, it's pretty clear. They learned it in law school. But be that as it may, I'm willing to, you know, just take that part out, which the CS does. Just leaves it the way it is. You'd have to go to Superior Court to challenge these regulations. It additionally makes it clear that the exemptions that are identified for Board of Fish, Board of Game, and Limited Entry Commission apply to all the new requirements that leave them status quo. I think that's appropriate, because the Board of Fish and the Board of Game and Limited Entry do extensive, more public hearings now, I think, than the average bureaucracy that's adopting regulations. They're also faced with difficult management decisions that could present themselves in a much more short time problem that they have to adjust quickly to. So the CS totally exempts them from the changes and leave them under the current system. Department of Corrections is also proposed to be exempted from these changes. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, as we go through, I'm very open to any specific arguments from specific agencies about why they are, should also be exempted if they have any particular things they can articulate that sets what the business they have to do by regulation apart from the general business within the state bureaucracy. And I'd be open to possibly exempting other departments if they can make a good case for it.
Senator Donnelly, I was curious as to exemptions to fish and game and corrections. I can understand it under some of the sections, but not on the cost and benefit. I realize they have extensive, especially Board of Fish and Board of Game, extensive public comment, and probably gets more public comment than anything that any departments do. But, don't you think it would be a good idea to have a cost and benefit ratio on some of their?
Chairman, I think it's always a good idea to have, when you adopt a regulation, to know that it's going to be more positive than not. But some of these things have been pointed out, or it's difficult to do that kind of analysis on some of the natural resource or the fish and wildlife questions are much more difficult to ascertain. And I do see that they are frequently presented with difficult management decisions that have to be made quickly based on events that happen out there in the environment that season. And so I didn't want to bog them down with any more difficult hoops to jump through for those kind of decisions, because they have to be made so timely based on that. And it may be very short seasons they have to deal with. They have to make adjustments in a very short period of time. But I do think this would be a tremendous step forward as it is.
Well, Senator Donnelly, they can still do that under the emergency regulation portion. And I understand that they issue lots of emergency orders and under, for the management of that. And I'm not necessarily saying that they ought to do a cost benefit on an emergency order necessarily, but if they adopt an emergency order into regular regulation or emergency, take an emergency regulation and adopt it as a permanent regulation, I'm not too sure that shouldn't be required to do it cost of benefit. I'm asking, I'm not sure.
Well, why don't we take some testimony? I'd like to get the committee substitute at least before us. Senator Donnelly, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move for the adoption of the CS, the Bannister version 1LS0274D, 12699, which has the changes that I described earlier to the committee. I hope that will help focus the testimony more directly.
Any objection? There being no objection, the committee substitute has been adopted as the bill before us. I think we have a sign-up sheet. I don't have it here in front of me, but who would like to first testify? Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jack Kreinheader. I'm with the Office of Management and Budget, and I've been involved for the past several years in a regulation working group with the administration to quote a famous phrase. This feels a bit like deja vu all over again. My notes tell me that I was in the same chair on April 9th, 1997, testifying on a prior version of this bill. I will keep my remarks brief, since they're fairly similar as they were then, although perhaps for Senator Torgerson's benefit, since he wasn't on the committee then, I'll recap them briefly. think most importantly, I'd like to say that the administration fully supports the overall objective of this legislation, which is to make the regulation process as responsive as possible and accommodating of concerns of public and industry. There have been a number of steps taken in this area over the last several years. One step that was taken back in 1995 was the issuance of an administrative order by Governor Knowles dealing fairly comprehensively with the regulation making process and directing state agencies to take a number of steps. And I'm not sure if that's in your file. And to briefly recap the provisions of that administrative order, among other things, it directed agencies use plain English wherever possible as opposed to technical or legal jargon, to minimize the cost to the public of complying with state regulations, which is in part, I think, one of the objectives of Senator Donnelly's bill. And to encourage state agencies to work with the public to accomplish the objectives of the underlying statute and the regulations also. In addition, and I might say that I think agencies have been doing a good job of following the spirit of that administrative order. And one other element I would note is that the governor also directed every department to review their existing regulations on the books with an eye towards identifying any outdated regulations or areas that could be revised to make it easier for the public to comply with those regulations. And departments have been going through that process over the last couple of years, although it's they've had to juggle the time to do that with the time they're spending to implement new regulations in response to statutes. One comment in response to Senator Donnelly's comment about the volume of regulations, that's certainly a perception issue. I guess my response would be that it's a little bit like statutes. There's people who say the darn legislature passes too many laws, and what do we need all these laws for? And as we know, as Senator Donnelly pointed out, it's a complicated society out there. There's new issues. We've got the internet commerce. We've got things that didn't exist a few years ago. And certainly the legislature needs to respond to that, and agencies respond by passing or adopting regulations to implement those. The one other step that was taken in the last several years was the passage a few years ago of Senate Bill 130, I believe that's in 1995 also, I'm sorry, House Bill, and that required state agencies to consider the cost of compliance by the public, to solicit cost of compliance for complying with proposed regulations. And I think agencies have been doing a good job of trying to minimize the cost of compliance by the public. Deb Baer from Department of Law will go into some of the more technical aspects on this. With regard to the committee substitute, I believe it does address some of the administration's concerns and makes some improvements. However, we do still have other concerns. Probably the biggest one is with the cost-benefit requirement. Again, certainly we support the concept here, but it's a question of cost and practicality. There's numerous examples you could draw. I guess one I would choose is speed limits. If there were a new regulation adjusting speed limits, how would you really calculate, how would the Department of Transportation calculate the cost and hurt the benefits of regulation and the underlying statute into dollars and cents is very difficult. And the other problem is that these can't just be a back of the envelope calculation. They have to stand up in court, and we're concerned that they would really have to be done thoroughly and done well, or some of these regulations could be overturned, and then the program or underlying statute cannot be implemented. There's also a balance there between doing a thorough assessment and analysis for proposed regulations and getting the regulations adopted in a timely manner. I imagine all of you on the committee have had the experience of having some of your legislation adopted and being frustrated with how long it took agencies to get the regulations implemented. So again, that's another concern. Finally, on fiscal notes, there have been fiscal notes from a number of departments here. They total in excess of $1.5 million. And it may seem like a lot of money. Again, it's with the idea that these cost-benefit analyses would have to be done very thoroughly, would have to stand up in a court of law, and that takes money and staffing to do so. With that, I'd one other closing comment. I just wanted to congratulate Chairman Senator Taylor on your appointment to the Regulation Review Committee. We've had a good working relationship with Representative James over the last couple of years, and we look forward to working with you in the regulation area as well. Be happy to take any questions.
I don't have any questions either, but I'm curious. The 1995 memo, Administrative Order 157, we passed through the legislature in early 95, I believe, in 96, but I think it was early 95, a bill requiring agencies to do a cost-benefit analysis report to the legislature to let us know what it was costing us to implement federal laws, mandates, so that we would have some handle on what these new federal mandates were costing the people of the state of Alaska. Governor Knowles vetoed that. But at the time he vetoed it, this is unique to my experience, usually if a signing's going to occur, you get invited up to the governor's office, and you stand there, get your picture taken with it, and the governor signs the bill and then hands you the pen he signed it with, and you send it to people that may have been involved in lobbying or whatever for that particular proposal. On this occasion, there were no cameras present. Of course, we never have that. That's never happened in 4 years. Usually the Democrats get invited up and fought against us, you know, and they are the ones that stand there and get their picture taken when a bill is signed. But the interesting thing to me was I was handed the pen after he vetoed it. And I said, well, why am I here exactly? And he said, well, because I want you to know that I really want this done and that we're going to do it, but we don't want to be required to do it. And it seems to me that, because he promised they was going to do this, looks to me like this is kind of a response maybe to that, or maybe just to the overall question of should the public know and should the legislature know what the imposition of either regulation or federal mandates or even our laws are going to cost. Here in the legislature, of course, we find that out because we get fiscal notes on every bill going through, so at least we know how much it's going to cost the state. We don't necessarily know what the cost of those laws are going to be to the general public. But it just seems odd to me that there is there are 24, now 25 fiscal notes attached to this bill where every department has said that it would either be impossible for them to do it or very difficult for them to do it, and that's to do the cost-benefit analysis. And yet for the last 3-plus years, June 95, the governor has been asking, and according to your testimony, the agencies have been complying with basically the very same concepts that are within the bill. I mean, I highlighted things here in the memo. I the very, very first one on the page, first page was minimize the cost to the public of complying with state regulations. Well, you can't minimize unless you know what the costs are to the public. So somebody has to do a cost-benefit analysis before they can take that extra step to be able to assure to themselves or their department head that they're in compliance with the governor's request and that they have, in fact, minimized that cost. The same thing is recurring as kind of a theme throughout this this order. Each agency shall consider known and potential costs to the public of complying with the regulations and to the extent possible shall draft the regulations so as to minimize those costs. Again, you can't do that unless somebody has done a cost-benefit analysis. The stuff about notification to the public and so on, I guess we can go into later, but I guess I'm trying to understand your testimony that you're doing all of this, and yet the reality of these fiscal notes would indicate that it what you're doing can't possibly be done without the assistance of an expert in either economics or some type of cost-benefit analysis. Can you respond to that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think the distinction there is in the difference between minimizing the cost to the public of complying and doing a full cost-benefit analysis that not only looks at the cost of compliance by the public, but trying, as I said, trying to quantify the benefit of the regulation. And if you flip through the book, almost any of these areas, what's the benefit to the public of a regulation on concealed handgun permits? Presumably there's some public safety benefit there, but I'm an economist by training, and if you ask me to turn that into dollars and cents to do a good job, it's going to take quite a bit of research time. And there's, as I say, if you flip through there, I think you'd find dozens of examples. So state agencies are doing their best, I believe, to minimize the cost to the public and collect that information from the people who would be affected by these regulations. But there's a big difference between doing that and doing a formal cost-benefit analysis.
Senator Donnelly, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I take a look at item number 10 under the executive order. Although it doesn't apply to new regulations, it does say that for all old existing regulations, the departments were supposed to submit to the governor a plan in consultation with the Department of Law regarding existing regulations that examined the cost to the regulated public. Well, the actual quote here is whether or not the cost to the public is excessive when compared to the state's interest in or benefit from the particular requirement. So as far as existing regulations, the executive order called for a cost-benefit analysis, both sides, not just the cost, but also the benefit analysis. So that seems inconsistent with opposition to doing it for future regulations.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Donnelly, my understanding of this provision would be that agencies have been asked to consider the cost of the public in comparison to the state's benefit, but that what's required here is not, as I say, putting in dollars and cents the public value of a speed limit, concealed handgun permits, any particular type of regulation. I think in general, when DOT is flipping through their statutes, they come to speed limits, they'd say, well, there's some cost to the public. They have to drive a little slower than they might otherwise, but clearly the public benefit outweighs that. They don't go out and spend months trying to calculate the dollars and cents applied to that.
Senator Torgerson.
You made some good examples on reasons why this won't work. Can you give us an example of a regulation that was changed to minimize the cost to the public?
One that comes to mind would be in the water quality area with mixing zones. where in some cases the cost of meeting federal water quality guidelines can be excessive or economically prohibitive. You know, a good example is the mine development we've got just north here of Juneau, or the Echo Bay mine that was under consideration here, where trying to get the water at the discharge point to meet federal standards would make the project uneconomic, but a mixing zone of a certain size would allow that project to go forward. That would be one example, or where settling ponds are allowed instead of, you know, some kind of filtration system. That's one that comes to mind off the top of my head. I'd be happy to collect some more examples for you and get those to you.
I would appreciate that. That's an interesting example. I would not have assumed that the department did that on their own to minimize the cost. That was that whole policy was in question as to whether or not we're exceeding federal requirements that was mandating this, and they actually exceeded the federal requirements in the initial regulations, and if they hadn't have done it that way, the legislature would have done something with that mixing zone problem. So I would appreciate some different examples of dealing with something that exceeds federal mandates.
Senator Donnelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to understand the distinction here between what the governor asked for former regulations to what we're asking for new regulations.
I might be able to help there. I think it's the same thing he told me 4 years ago. We don't mind doing it. We want to do it, or at least we want the public to think we're doing it. But we don't want to be ordered to do it by the legislature.
Okay.
I think that's really what it's about.
And possibly it's that if you took the most restrictive reading of the language that's in the CS, that the agency shall make a cost-benefit analysis, it would mean strictly an economic one. As I drafted this, I always recognize there may be non-economic issues involved in these types of things. That you can't easily quantitate in dollars and cents terms. Would it be helpful and more consistent with the governor's position if we put a provision in there that recognized that there may be times where that cost-benefit analysis may depend on non-economic issues?
I think it would. Some recognition that that some of these things are difficult to quantify, and that the dollars on the benefit side don't always have to exceed the dollars on the cost side.
Okay. I'd be willing to. If you've got any suggestions on how to clarify that, I'd welcome that.
I'd be happy to work
okay.
with senior staff on that.
Yeah. But you know, there's like there may be values such as I'll give you an example, undergrounding overhead power lines. I mean, there's good safety reasons to do it. There's good maintenance reasons to do it. There may also be aesthetic reasons to do it that you can't easily put a dollar and cents value.
And yet it may cost more to run underground than to hang it in the air.
Right.
For the committee's benefit or interest, having become this chair of this committee, I received quite a pile of documents from the Lieutenant Governor on the 20th of January, and I was curious as I started through them. They appeared to be just regular, you know, we get these every the one group of people that does get notice of regulatory changes is legislators. We get these things constantly. I don't know how many people actually read them or read through them. I always try to, and sometimes I find them fascinating, but most of the time they're not on the top of my reading list. But as you as I go through what's been submitted by the departments at this time and what's under consideration at the Lieutenant Governor's office, here's what I run into, which is, I think, kind of interesting. There's all sorts of changes done in the longhand to each one of these. And I don't mean little changes. I mean huge changes. You start going through them, and there are page after page. It looks like this. And so I was curious, and I thought, well, boy, those are, I mean, these are significant changes to the regulation that has been submitted. So I had staff go find out, well, who was making, I mean, changes like this to all these regulations. Well, after they've given public notice, after they've had their public comment period, after the agency has drafted its new regulatory changes, and they're now submitting them to our lieutenant governor for review and signature, this is just what the changes made by the Department of Law.
And the public never
the public is never going to see any of this. They're not going to be aware of it. And as we all know from serving here in the legislature, the change of one word from a may to a shall, the change of one word from a not to a yes, so to speak, can have huge, huge impacts on the way that regulation may impact people in the public or in the business sector that are being regulated by it. And I just thought you might find that interesting that even after going through all those processes, here are these almost complete rewrites of these regulations that are taking place at Department of Law, who then makes those recommendations to the Lieutenant Governor. Lieutenant Governor, I assume, looks those over and then sends them back to the department or writes them themselves in final form. I'm not sure which one of them does it. We're going to find that out, I guess. Maybe Deborah can help us. She's up next. But I thought that was very interesting, the significance of change that occurs just in drafting at the final stage. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Deb, you're up next.
For the record, I'm Deborah Baer, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, and I am Regulations Attorney for the State of Alaska. And I'm very pleased to be here to be able to talk to this committee and any committee of the legislature about ways to improve the regulation process. I wanted to comment first on the CS. It is an improvement over the original bill, but we still have technical problems with the bill, and I'll be glad to go through our concerns. First of all, as mentioned, I don't want to go through a lot. The concepts in this bill have been introduced before several legislatures. The legislatures in the past, I believe, have rejected these changes for two reasons. One is the significant fiscal impact that this will cause on the regulatory process. And frankly, given the budget framework that we're looking at, I don't think there is extra dollars available to do this. And then second, it provides a handy target for litigation challenges for people who are opposed to the content of the regulations, especially when you're talking about large development projects where people want to stop a timber sale, stop oil development, stop opening a pipeline. I can tell you right now, if I wanted to stop any of these, I would go through, and I can tell you where I would go through and challenge them. But those are, to me, the two biggest issues. When you turn some of these provisions are mandatory requirements. That means if they're not precisely followed, the court has an obligation to review and can void the regulations if they believe we haven't met. On the cost-benefit analysis, you've spent a lot of time like that, and I really don't want to take a whole lot more on it because I think Senator Donnelly's recognition of that some benefits cannot be quantified is probably my biggest concern. And I can tell you where that came in, an example like opening the Hall Road. You start looking at the cost of opening the Hall Road. And I can tell you, we were in court over this. The first wave of fiscal notes, in every regulation adopted in the state of Alaska, you must do a fiscal note with it. And you have to do a cost of, if there's going to be any cost absorbed by state agencies. The first wave on that, DOT only included their own costs, their own. The court came back and said, no, you have to include trooper costs and other state agency costs. That delayed opening the Hall Road approximately at least a year or a year and a half. If we had to go forward and include other costs, I can tell you that people who did not want the Hall Road open and will be talking about cultural impacts on their communities, damage to environment, whatever. We would have to cost that to the satisfaction of a court. When you're looking at benefits on the other side, frankly, most of them are very difficult to cost out, such as the value of tourism, value of economic development, the value of people being able to travel on public highways. I can tell you if this bill was in place, I don't think we could have this opening the whole row could have withstood a constitutional test. It could have withstood this kind of a challenge. I can go through more examples of it, but I frankly I think you folks have gotten to the point, and I'm particularly concerned when the definitions of public and cost and benefit are not clear. And this is especially the case where you have competing Alaskans talking about the same project, such as like a timber sale or competing resources for land. I don't know how you weigh cost-benefit on that. Who is the public? Is it the I really don't know. I brought along one analysis that I got from Fishing Game on one regulation, and you can see the volume of it. And the net result, as I understand it from it, because I don't have time to look at it, was that they couldn't absolutely be certain. But there probably were some public benefits to it, but the precision wasn't there. And this is after a fairly lengthy study and an expense that the state would go through. If an economic analysis would come out with that, we could not adopt the regulation if we couldn't say with some precision that the benefits would exceed the cost and be able to stand up for it. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things that we're doing to reduce costs and give the people public notice of costs. I can tell you, since this bill is introduced, Senator Donnelly made an excellent point, and I have modified the regulation notices. They go out to the public, and there's a line right there that says if you are offering comments, please include the potential cost to private persons in complying with it. So in people commenting, they are encouraged through the notice to offer comments. Also, I worked with Senator Kelly on, who was then Representative Kelly on the House side, and we did get House Bill 130 in, which requires the state agency to consider costs to public parties in adopting regulations. And I can tell you that I do not accept an adoption order from any board, commission, or commissioner if there is not a sentence in there that says that they have considered the cost of public, paid special attention to the cost of private persons. I will return it. Also, the public, because boards and commissions have to do this deliberation in a public process, in a public meeting, the public can go and observe the meetings, and just as they can the legislative session, and check out and make sure that these public officials are weighing things in the appropriate balance. So as I can say, I've mentioned some of the things that I wanted to bring up, because it from the surface, this looks like an absolutely appropriate idea. I'm concerned right now we're going to be faced with budget cuts that have to be implemented fairly quickly. And I can tell you, last year when the budget cuts came out, there was not time to do the statutory amendments to match with them. A lot of them had to be done by regulations and had to be done very quickly. I can tell you I would be very doubtful that someone could do an adequate cost-benefit analysis on deleting Medicaid services that would stand up in court when you're weighing the cost to the public of deleting the service versus the benefit. You folks, when you're looking at the budget, or you're looking at it as a whole, you want to have a balanced budget. You're not looking at the cost of an individual regulation or individual policy. You're looking at state government as a whole. When I look at a reg, I would have to look and see the cost and benefit as to this particular regulation. To do an economic analysis that would justify this type of cost would probably take several months, maybe a year, and frankly wouldn't be looking at the elements that you folks look at when you look at it legislation. So I wanted you to think about that. And it comes up in the same issue with privatizing state services and increasing fees. In a budget, you can put an amount in on the budget of what you want it to be. Most of these have to be accomplished by regulation. We could not implement it without being able to show a cost-benefit analysis by the rating, by the fee increase. So I think although this has very good public policy to it, I'm concerned about in practice what it means in a climate where we don't have the money to do economic analysis that will stand up in court. Also, I'm concerned about our constitutional right of privacy. I cannot go to a private businessman and say to you, can you tell me how much this regulation is going to impact your business? Because I really do not want, I have to make sure that the costs to you don't exceed the benefits. This information is not available to me. I probably can't even get away with a subpoena. So I don't know how this information is, how we would do something that would withstand a court case on that involved business proprietary information. And I can tell you most regulations do, a lot of them do, And I can give you examples on it. The next point that I wanted to think about is, I was listening to Senator Donnelly about regs that are not working. And I think that's every public official has an obligation to make sure that regs continue to work. What I am concerned about is we have to do a cost-benefit analysis to remove regulations from the books that aren't working. And what if we couldn't show for some reason with the precision? Somebody could challenge that regulation, even though the commissioner may in fact say, my policy direction is for less regulation in this area. He would have to show with the precision of a cost-benefit analysis before he could take off repealed regulations. So some of the things that I tried to think of ways that we could do this where there wouldn't be a fiscal impact. I frankly can't think of ways to do it, but I could think of ways that might lessen the burden. One of them is to allow the commissioner to issue some sort of a determination when costs and benefits aren't reasonably ascertainable, or when it would be cost prohibitive to do an economic analysis. And I'm thinking of things like the state library wants to change from 10 cents a copy to 15 cents a copy for copying charges. So we did a cost-benefit analysis on that regulation. It would be cost prohibitive. I mean, it wouldn't even be worth raising the fee. Another thing that I thought about was only including major projects. And most of the I had a staff person work on the regulatory reforms that Congress has done. And most of them started out this broad. And what you'll find is they retrenched in a lot of cases to only the major projects, the $100 million type projects. But what I caution you on those kinds of projects is these are the ones where you're going to stop development, where you're providing an able issue for someone to challenge if this analysis isn't done right. Finally, I would seriously think about making that the cost-benefit analysis is not a basis to void a reg, and so that the court could order us to redo it, the Regulation Review Committee could bring us in, have us explain to it, and you could pass a statute to do it, but some way where you can't, where someone cannot stop a major project that people want, such as the Hall Road, because we didn't include the trooper cost or we didn't include whatever cost the court thought was appropriate at the time. So those are ideas that you can think of, but I can tell you, even with what I have said here, I know of no way to get it down to zero. The second issue that the bill brings up, and that Senator Donnelly has brought it up before, and I think it's a very legitimate and interesting concern, and that is the issue about supplemental notices. What this bill would do is require, if we go out for a public notice, and that includes mailing to anybody that wants a copy of it, providing copies to interested groups, providing newspaper notices, providing copies to legislators. Once we do that, we go out for public comment. The public comes back and says, look, DEC, DOT, you didn't get it right. I want this changed. DOT decides, you're right, public, we want to do this change for you. In order for us to do it under this bill, we would have to go through a whole new round of public comments. And I did do and notices and all that. And I did some checking on what it costs for these kinds of notices. The information I have from the Division of Insurance said a notice costs $1,500 for them, for all the mailings, copying. DEC just recently did some food service regs, and the notices were $3,700 per notice. That does not include boards or commissions, because boards or commissions have to consider, in fact, they'd have to consider these comments from the public and say, yes, we want to make a change. So we'd have a meeting to consider it. Then we'd have a meeting to send it out for public comment, and then we'd go out for another round. Now, if we decided as a result of the second round that we wanted to make another change, we would have to go out for another round of public comment. Now, the bill does have an escape hatch where it says a significant change in substance. But frankly, I think Senator Taylor's comments were right. Sometimes a minor change to a deliberative body may think it's not a significant change, but to the court later may say it is a significant change. And I'm worried, again, where I've talked about delays. I can tell you when you start talking about mines, opening roads, delays may mean the end of a project that the Alaska public wants, just because you're going to throw up rounds and rounds of public comments. Again, we, the state agencies are not budgeted for these additional costs, so I know of no way to reduce it. There's no limit on it. I also see it ripe for court challenges when with the words like significant change in section. I mentioned about things like delays. I have concerns about construction seasons. I can tell you one set of regulations I did was to get money out to the private sector to do, it was for senior housing. If I found legal problems in the regulations at the very last minute, which we can talk about some of the edits there, and I sent them back to the commissioner who was doing them, and they said, you're entirely right, there are legal problems with those. Commissioner readopted it, but if we had to go out for another round of public comments based on legal concerns, we would have missed the construction season. There's no question in my mind on that.
Ask you a question. That specific example, was that to comply with federal mandates?
No. It was just totally state-funded project.
Okay. And it wouldn't fall. The bill has an exception for if there's an emergency situation. If you would have missed the dollars, I think you could argue that you couldn't be able to do it without that.
But this was not a missing of dollars because it was a state-funded program. The dollars would have been there. The only thing you would have missed was the construction season.
Okay.
And then there's some things that have to start at the beginning of a calendar year. Some of your taxes have to, school season start, PFD. If I don't have regulations in place at the start of the PFD year, the courts will come in and say you can't impose new requirements or whatever later. So it's an important thing to consider when you want to do quick budget and policy changes at the end of this year and you want them in place quickly, and they have to be done by reg. It's a difficult thing to do when you have an open-ended set of supplemental notices. What I wanted to tell people are there is checks within the APA on the amount of change that a state agency can make. First of all, it has to be within the scope of the notice. And I can tell you at least once a week, I tell a state agency they cannot make a change because it wasn't noticed to the public. It isn't in the scope of the notice. Second is they have to have the legal authority from you folks to do it. If they don't, it won't get past my desk. Second thing is the Constitution has a requirement of notice and due process. So if it is way out, it hasn't been out there, people can constitutionally challenge the regulations and they won't get through our office either. But in terms of changes that are done to respond to public comments, to respond to legal concerns that are within the scope of the notice, that is appropriate within the APA for legal sign-off. What some of the commissioners are doing right now is at the time that the regulations are adopted is they are putting them on the internet, and I found that's quite popular with people, and they're voluntarily doing that. Also, the administrative journal, when a commissioner adopts the regulation, they put a little summary in it and goes in the administrative journal. And so that's another way that the public is informed of that the regulations are available. Regulations are, of course, public records. Anybody wants a copy and get them, not a problem. Some of the suggestions in this area that I tried, as I say, I tried my best to come up with things that could be done for minimal cost, was encouraging the commissioners to continue to put adopted regulations on the internet. Require only exempt boards and commissions from this kind of requirement because all their deliberative process making is done in a public meeting, just the same as yours are done. You might want to exempt regs that were a result of negotiated rulemaking. Representative James spent a lot of time coming up with a very interesting process on negotiated rulemaking where the public and the private sector come in with an idea and it goes out for public comment. If changes had to be made, fine-tuning as a result of that public process, I don't know if there would be great economic value in going out for another round of public comment. And again, you might want to consider not voiding the regulation if for some reason someone guesses wrong on whether or not that's a significant change in public comment. And
could you explain, could you back up one
sure.
point? I didn't fully understand your point about the administrative rulemaking.
Administrative journal?
No, I didn't understand.
Negotiated
rulemaking.
Yes.
Could you explain that?
Yeah, that's a new
detail bill.
It just came in last year, and it was enacted into law. And Representative James worked on it and through her chair of the Regulation Review Committee. And what it does, it allows commissioners to establish a working group of public-private, a state agency has a place at the table but doesn't have a controlling majority at the table, and they come out with negotiated principles, negotiated regulations, a set of regulations. If they can't, they come out with a report telling the commissioner where their consensus was. Why it is so good from a legal perspective is once this is negotiated, the whole project goes out for public comment, so that everyone in the public has a right to comment on it. The problem why state agencies aren't using it a lot is there was no money to fund it. And so if that's an area that you might want to consider putting some funding in and encouraging pilot projects in this area, because it does have the possibilities of making the public more comfortable with what decisions are being made. Okay, the third major thing that this bill does is what I call, establishes what is called a presumption of invalidity of a regulation. In other words, when a court, even if we did all this right, even if we did the Hall Road right, everything right, we go into court and the court cannot uphold a reg unless it is the least intrusion on the rights and property of persons affected by the regulations or a compelling interest is shown. I can tell you a compelling interest to me is going to be a constitutionally protected right. It's going to be something of that significance. So right now under existing law, what the court does is as soon as the reg is filed, it's presumed to be valid. And then the person who has a problem with it comes in and shows that there's a problem with the APA or the Constitution has been met or they've exceeded the statutory authority. But at least business has a stability that they know what the rules are going to be. Under this, I couldn't guarantee any businessman that any reg could withstand the least intrusive rights on public persons affected by the regulation of compelling interest. Take the Hall Road, for example. I don't know how you could ever show a court or a state agency could show to the court's satisfaction that that was the least intrusion rights of public property to open the Hall Road. I don't know how. And I can go through more examples of that, but
Before you move on,
sure.
Don't we use a standard very similar to that in phrasing on condemnation and the right of eminent domain?
I would have to look. I'm not a condemnation attorney. I'd have to look at it for you.
Oh, I'm not really either,
yeah.
Of course, but I do recall something about there has to be justification for us to, if we're going to build a new highway and we have to drive it right through the middle of your house. Before we have the right to take your house, we have to show, I believe, a compelling public interest. Now, the word compelling may not be in there. It may be just public interest of any type. But the courts over the years throughout the United States have had to make decisions about that. I remember when they built I-5 down through the middle of the state of Washington, I don't know how many thousands of houses had to be removed and people lost their homes. I know there were challenges to that. People saying, well, if you just move the road over a little bit, you wouldn't have to take my house, and there's a farmer's land that you'd be taking and that doesn't have a lot of homes on it. Why aren't you designing it so that it goes a little ways away from my house? So I know there is that standard. I just don't know what the actual words are. But in other words, that's a system that we have worked with and used for years because it involves a taking. And that, of course, is another word that's getting a lot of discussion in anymore in the courts. But I would like to have that, to keep that thought in mind, and maybe you can respond back to us on that, because it seems to me that if it works well enough for taking a person's property, a regulation might very well have the same impact upon a business.
It's because of the broad range of types of regulations. The one that I could just respond to as an example right now is we require people who are going to be daycare providers to go through a criminal background check. And to go through a criminal background check, I had to show least intrusive rights of public and property, why don't I just take the affidavit from the person? Why do we have to have a criminal? That's the kind of thing. It's not the same as going in and taking someone. There are many different competing interests. So for some of these things, I could look at it on the cost-benefit analysis, and it might just work very fine. But when you're doing a global set of standards that have to go across a myriad of programs, it's real hard to tailor something that's going to walk the line and work for every program. And I appreciate your alerting me to that, and I'll be glad to look at that. Okay, again, I've talked, no regulations would be exempted under the least intrusive standard, and things I can, you know, I brought up some, but like fire codes, any kind of public protection regulation would have a really hard time defending it. I think people who want to challenge it could basically, basically this standard is the state loses unless we show. And that's not a stable environment for business to operate under. I have a question whether that's what you want, even if we're doing it as directed by you through the budget. I mean, because even if you as the budget say, I want to delete this Medicaid service, if I couldn't show that is the least intrusive on the rights of public property, the court could say, I can't get rid of the regulation. The legislature should do it by statute change. And so it's going to cause unintended consequences and stopping development, paying large attorney's fees to special interest groups that I don't think we're real interested in paying them to. And so those are the kinds of issues that bother me. In this, again, the current standard. It provides people an ample opportunity to come in and test it. If we aren't meeting the constitutional standards of due process, we aren't meeting the statutory obligations. You've said we can do a reg in this area, and we can't in that area. And that's one thing I want to suggest to the legislature. If you put a statute in that says you may not do a regulation on X, I can tell you, we will not allow, the Department of Law will not allow to go forward, and I'm sure a commissioner wouldn't even attempt it. And so by the clearer the statutes are, and even if you can't do the fine-tuning, you may know specific areas that you don't want the state agencies to enter into. If you would clearly say that in a statute, regulations may not be adopted. So I can provide more information to you on that, but I think I've taken enough points. And I agree with Senator Donnelly's suggestion to take out the district court from here. And I can give you examples if you need it, but I agree with him. Finally, on
the district court is supposed to take that.
Well, I mean to take out the review at the district court level.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Finally, the last point that's made in the bill, and it's on essentially requiring the Regulation Review Committee to review all regulations every 10 years. I think you have that authority now. The only thing I would suggest is that your principal departments list in there, I think, is too narrow. You've admitted some departments that, in fact, do adopt regulations. For example, the Office of the Governor adopts public records regs that impact every citizen in the state of Alaska. The governor's office is not listed in there. The University of Alaska has an obligation to do procurement regulations. They are not listed in there. So you might want to look at that. Also, I always question when it's reviewing every regulation if that's a wise use of public resources and whether you want to just pinpoint audits to problem areas. But that is a policy decision that you frankly can make. And again, we are more than willing to work with you on it. I hope I've raised lots of things for people to have discussion about. And I welcome the opportunity to talk with you more about the projects in this or any regulation project you have.
One that was brought to my attention recently, Deborah, by the way, I really appreciate the depth in which you've gone through this. Very good. Valley General Hospital has been applying to have its Medicaid payments made pursuant to existing regulations, Department of Health and Social Services. They first applied, put in their application. They were turned down. They challenged that by appealing it administratively to the commissioner. The commissioner then appointed a hearing officer to conduct a full-blown hearing on it. Attorneys, accountants, doctors, others testified. It was a lengthy hearing. At the end of the hearing officer agreed completely mm-hmm. with every single issue raised by Valley General Hospital out Palmer. Mm-hmm. He rendered his opinion. It went up to the commissioner. The commissioner immediately sent the opinion back down, apparently because she didn't like it, and asked that there be a further rehearing. They've now been through four of those. The commissioner has now sent it back down again because she still doesn't like the fact that every time she sends it down for a hearing, she finds out that she was wrong. Unfortunately, you see, as long as it's tied up in the administrative law game, Valley General can't get to court. So we're talking of a system, and this, by the way, since I've made inquiries about it, since hearing about this one, I found out there's hospitals all over the state that are being treated the same way, that the total amount involved may be millions of dollars. And while those people aren't being paid because of apparently a misinterpretation internally within the department of their own regulations, at least it's a misinterpretation according to their own hearing officer four times over now, those people aren't getting their money. That means the rest of us on the paying public have to figure out a way that we end up paying for that. And the cost of medical care in major hospitals across the state goes up to all the rest of us because they still have to pay their nurses and doctors, even though the state is refusing to pay them. It's examples like that that cause us real concern about the due process aspects of these regulations, and that there must be at some point in time a way to get off the bureaucratic merry-go-round, if you will, and get to somebody who's objective, not part of the department, not a commissioner or some political appointee, but get to somebody that that actually wears a robe and gets paid to be a judge, not paid to be a member of that department. And that sort of example, and I know it's anecdotal, and there's probably lots of reasons for that thing happening and so on. It's just that's the kind of things we get hit with, and it's very frustrating for us to then look back through the Administrative Procedures Act that we as a legislature created and not come up with something to try and alleviate those problems. So any thoughts you also might have on ways to get out of the system so as to get a more definitive response maybe out of the court system, some finality, I guess that's what I'm looking for, some finality that could be assured once the appellate process or the review process has been started.
I will be referring your question. We have a hearing officers committee in the Department of Law, and there are people who do this every day of the week, and I'll be referring your question to and have an attorney call you back.
Great. I appreciate it. Senator Torgerson?
Having not served on Regulation Review Committee, which it seems like what we're getting into here, I wonder if you know of any examples where the regulations that were adopted substantially changed the intent of the legislation on which drove the regulations to be adopted. That's one question. And the other one, if through the regulation process, if there is or has been attempts to stop the intent of the legislation by not adopting the regulations.
I can answer a couple of questions here. One is the intent of the legislation. Alaska is very different than other states than in Congress. We don't have the committee reports and the consensus reports so that people and a court or a judge later looking down can get the collective intent of the legislature on bills. So I would tell you, if you are concerned about it, provide as much legislative history as you can through purpose, through intent statements, through the exact language of the statute itself, and then you have less chance of it getting a result that you do not believe that they followed your intent or whatever. Because that's the biggest problem when a judge comes in 3 or 4 years later and then has to divine what the collective intent was of the legislature for it. I can tell you if it does not follow the strict intent of the statutes, it won't get out of my office, and it's certainly no judge will uphold it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Donnelly. I think he asked if you were aware of any examples.
I think she...
That would be something you'd need to respond back later on.
Right. I can provide an example. The ignition interlock regulations. They didn't get adopted for over 5 years, and finally former Representative Grunberg sued the state to try to compel them to adopt the regulations to implement the statute.
I know of several in the child welfare situations, too, but and I've heard of a lot more, a lot of war stories that even to go past the intent. I said intent, but I really meant the letter of the legislation, or the actual statute that was adopted. There's a lot of war stories that when it got through the regulation process, there was nothing that the legislation was directed to do. It was, the intent of the legislation was changed, as well as the letter of the legislation, by adopting the regulation. That's what a lot of my frustration is, and a lot of the frustration that I hear from businesses and other folks, and how much that's changed. You brought up an interesting point. This is, you said that we might be able to, you said we might be able to put in our legislation, regulations may not be adopted, substantially change the intent of the legislation. And maybe that's something, and you said if you if we had that in a bill, you would
yeah,
not.
Yeah, and it's not an APA type of bill. It's not this type of a bill. But if you were doing a bill on, handguns or whatever, and you said there can't be this, you can't charge a fee over $100, I can assure you that regulation would not come in with a fee over $100. Or you may not charge fees for the service, or you may not require background checks of whatever. The regulation will not have it in there. If you have a specific direction how you want to go in the substantive law, but the APA is a framework under which all state agencies adopt regulations, so it has to apply to everybody. So I would look at, as you're doing substantive law bills, if you have provisions that you don't want people to adopt regulations on, make sure you're clear in the bill.
Do they have a constitutional problem if you separation of powers or something?
Mm. Regulations are delegated power from the legislature to the executive branch.
So I'm almost suggesting that we put it on the bottom of every bill.
Yes.
It's just an automatic new section in every bill that says be careful what you adopt. Worded in legalese.
Sure. Deborah, the other side of the question, John's question, Senator Torgerson's question, I should say, I think it's a very good one. Examples of laws that we passed that either did not get regulations drafted. I always consider that kind of a pocket veto on the part of the governor. The law gets passed, he fought it all the way, and then I'll be darned, that agency just can't get around to doing regulations on it for the next 5 years. So, of consequence, the law never goes into effect. I actually had the very same thing happen with a bill I passed that required Canadian fishing boats, if they were going to use our harbors and ports, that they had to announce to the Fish and Game Department the species and number of fish they had on board. And there's a tremendous use of our harbors, at least, on the lower end of Prince of Wales Island and other places, by the Canadian fishing fleet, who come in there at night rather than run all the way across Dixon Entrance. And, you know, Fish and Game didn't like that one, because even though the Malaspina had been pirated twice by the Canadians, we didn't want to upset the Canadians, is what I was told. So for about 2 years after that, we couldn't get the regulations passed until I personally went to the Board of Fish and Game and insisted that they might do something. They have, by the way, they have never been enforced. I mean, we could go on and on. I think the other side of that question, the one that bothers me just as much, is that I watch this administration bring legislation before the legislature. It fails to pass, and as soon as the legislature's out of town, each of the departments that were advocating for those changes immediately go in and redraft and come up with a whole bunch of brand new regulations that just happened to carry out almost everything they were trying to do in the law that they couldn't get through the legislature. So some examples of that would be kind of fun to look at, too. And we've seen that happen time and again. Those are just some examples that we're
It's one thing that the regulation,
are there ways to get around it?
The Regulation Review Committee could, as a bill passes, if you see something that you want to know the progress on it, you can always schedule a meeting and ask for the progress on how the regulation is doing.
Yes, Senator Dobb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to thank you for, these are a lot of new suggestions. We've been working on this for almost 6 years together, and today has been probably the most productive single day for constructive suggestions on how to focus this bill better than we've heard from the administration the last 6 years. So I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. There's a lot of good ideas here that I like, actually. One thing I would ask, could you give me, maybe give me some feedback on what would be more appropriate in the view of the administration as far as a standard for the court, the compelling reason standard? You mentioned that it might meet a constitutional protection standard. Would substantial be a better word there? Or maybe you could, you don't have to do it off, I don't expect you to do it off the top of your head right now, but if you could come back with a recommendation for that, I'd appreciate that. I particularly like the idea of having the some discretion with the commissioner based on if it's a small, you know, cost effective to do the analysis. If it's a minor thing, they should have the freedom to do that. I think that's a good idea. I appreciate that suggestion today. Also, Senator Taylor's raised a really good point. I think it would be good to include in this legislation, and that would be some sort of statute of limitations on how long they can tie things up in the regulatory process. Maybe we could approach it from that angle, that after a certain part, at a certain point of time, after so many years, that people can go directly to court rather than continuing to be restrained by the current provisions in the APA, that you got to first have an administrative finality before you do that. That would be, I think, just that thing alone would be a significant advancement in the public interest, I think, in this, and frankly encourage the bureaucracy to make a decision in a more timely manner too, probably. So I've heard some really good things today. I'm really excited about this. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing us to bring it forward this early in the session so we could start working on some of these ideas.
Another item just came to mind when you mentioned that. Last year, near the close of the legislature, various people around here were being asked to hold committee hearings or hold some type of hearing on the issue of the valuation of state rights of way across state land. And I found it fascinating that these were major communications companies that had been requesting this for a lengthy period of time of the administration, and the administration had strong recommendations through the Department of Natural Resources as to what the method by which these valuations should take place. And in fact, they recommended we follow the federal model, which was value of use of the land, not benefit to be derived, so to speak. In other words, what is the land actually worth? And the feds did an appraisal process, and then they would, all their land was that price, 6 cents a foot or 2 cents a foot or whatever to go across it with a cable, buried underground cable. It had been 2 years that the department had been wrestling with these people over coming up with regulations. And in fact, there was no regulation because one department charged a different fee than another department did. And the whole thing got worked out by Mr. Shively in a back room where he basically said, this is what you're going to pay. And is that a good enough deal? And everybody went along with it. There are times, I think, when we really need to have a process for creating regulations that may not involve as much politics and should involve a little more openness than what we saw in that process. Because right now we have an entire industry, the communications industry, I don't think we know yet what their regulations are. Maybe those have now been finalized, but they certainly weren't at the time we were talking about it. And my last
one,
yeah, go ahead.
I don't want to give an idea of how many regulations you review a month or a year.
I would have to look at my statistics. It depends on the time of the year, but I can get that information for you if you'd like, some kind of average.
And when you're doing that, maybe you could get us an average timeline of a regulation.
A timeline from processing?
Process.
Okay, the time...
I have that in regulation review. I know this is off the subject of this a little bit, but...
Sure, just so I'm clear, from the time the agency does the initial notice to the time I sign off
on it? Hard to stop. So... I think Senator Donnelly and Senator Taylor brought up good points that maybe there should be a timeline in there. If that timeline's 2 years or 1 year or 6 months, then you have to know how long the average one takes, I would think.
They are talking about two different things. They're talking about administrative adjudication, which is after the regulations adopted.
Well, I thought you also were talking about if the regulation wasn't adopted in a certain period of time, then you'd have a direct access to the court, wouldn't that?
It could apply to that, too. That's the example of the ignition interlock example, where
that's what I was filed
a writ of mandamus, which is a Latin thing to compel the government to take an action that it's legally required to do.
You're teaching me new words here, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure I came to this court.
Well, here, the Judiciary Committee, I'm allowed to
figure out a few of those things here. I'm not sure I'm here to learn Latin.
I'll tell you, it's always fascinated me, Senator Torgerson, that we live in a state that deleted and removed all of what are called extraordinary writs from the court system. And yet, so you don't have names for them anymore. We kind of took the names away years ago. But when you want to force the state to do something, everybody still calls it a writ of mandamus. There isn't any other name, I guess, for it. So, but according to our rules, our court rules, we don't have any of those left anymore. There are no special writs left.
Call it an order to do what you were supposed to do.
Yeah. Good. I'm understanding law.
Yeah. And maybe that's what we need to do, is start calling them those things. I mean, for crying out loud, ever since Vatican II, we don't have to do this stuff in Latin anymore.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I did want you to respond to this, if you could, and it looks to me as though, and I guess the problem that I sensed when I looked at this was that each of these departments that submit regulations to you, I know from going through the budgeting process, each one of them have a BRU, or whatever they call it, with the Attorney General's office. Many of them have attorneys assigned internal that do nothing but work with the department, and I'm assuming one of their primary functions is the drafting of regulations. And so I'm assuming that whatever department submitted this to you had its own attorneys type this thing up and send it to you, or at least the ones that work for them through the Attorney General's office. And then when it gets to you, it still has to go through this process.
Because of the staffing levels of the Department of Law, I wish that we could sit down with an agency early on before we go out for public notice and ascertain every little legal issue so there was no problem with it. But we aren't staffed up at that level. And so what will happen is it'll be someone who is a trial attorney who may be able to, while they're during the public comment period, but definitely after they're initially adopted, sit down with the commissioner and go over with the legal problems and identify them and then repair them, and then they come up to me. I do regulations in my off-season 100% of the time, during the legislative session about 50% of the time, and I'm a specialist in it. People who do not do this every day of the week miss stuff, and they miss the stuff that's important to you folks, like due process, like statutory construction. And so I will go through and I'll say, that's maybe a very fine public policy call, but you're going to have to go to the legislature and get a statute for it. So those are the kinds of things that I do, but I can assure you anything that is substantive, I take it back to the adopting authority, and the adopting authority has to readopt it. And that includes a border commission, or I disapprove it. I have disapproval authority under the statute if they aren't following the law. I wish that I could say that we were staffed up to a level that regulations would be typed, when, you know, that we could start at the beginning or we'd have final stuff when it's filed, but I can assure you that there are no policy decisions that are being made there that are not going back to the commissioners for adoption. And if the commissioner doesn't like it, we start over again.
Great. Thank you very much. Really appreciate your effort on this, Deborah.
Thank you. I'm glad to work with you.
Next person I had up was Pam LeBeau.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Pam LeBeau, and I'm president of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. And I've been fascinated by today's discussion. It's been really interesting. Of the chamber's 10 priorities that they adopted this year, and of the 12 they had last year, and the 10 each year for several years before, in second place, in, I believe, every one of the years except one where we had tort reform higher than regulatory reform. Regulatory reform has been one of our top two or three every year. And that's because, well, it's a huge area, and as has been expressed here today by Senator Donnelly, that these are, they carry the weight of law, they are laws, and you know how active business is in the making of laws. We are here all the time during the legislative session because this is so important to the way the business community conducts its business. And it's much harder to participate in the administrative process with as much success, and that's for sure. We do support Senate Bill 24. We support the committee substitute that's been offered today. We think that the cost-benefit analysis is something that we have been trying to achieve for quite some time. We were very active. We promoted HB 130, I think it was in 1996 that passed. And this was contained in that. We tried to get a cost-benefit analysis as a requirement. The best we could do was to get the agreement in there that they would consider, the agencies would consider the cost and benefit to the business when they, to those they were regulating. But yet, I think what I've heard today is that probably the governor's 1995 directive, his executive order, has been ignored because obviously it's entirely too costly to comply with that. And I think I've also heard that the consideration, that language that was written into HB 130, has been too costly to comply with, or they considered it and said it was too costly. The thing is, businesses every day of the world, in every decision they make, they say, what is this going to cost us and what is the benefit to this? Or, on the other hand, if we don't do it, what's the cost? What's the downside? It seems that every time a piece of legislation is considered, the very fact that a fiscal note is attached to it, if that isn't a cost analysis, I don't know what is. And also, it seems to me that agencies are never too concerned about the fiscal nature of the state when it comes to wanting an expansion of a program or more programs or new ones, and yet when it comes to something that requires some accountability, sometimes the cost becomes a real problem, and shame on us for even considering doing something that's going to cost government more to do. I think the suggestion today, the statute of limitations on the time allowed for regulations to be adopted, is just an excellent idea. I think that the fact that we have, that yesterday we heard about SJR 3, which would allow the legislature to repeal the regulations that don't follow their intent, is a very good idea. All of these regulatory issues are sort of building up because there is a great problem in business that they have to live by so many rules that are costly, and if they're valuable, if they're important, if they're necessary, then that's okay. But if they're just an exercise, how important is it? We think that we would like to work with the sponsor, with the committee, in any way we can to help achieve some change. One of the things that has distressed me as I've gone out in the past to my my members, the business community, some of the industries who are so heavily regulated, and asked for examples, specific examples as to problems they've had with the agencies, with not being heard or not having their input considered, or any of these specifics. And much to my distress, I've learned that in many cases, if it's important, if it's so egregious that they can't live with it, they end up taking it to court. And if it's less than that, even though it's an aggravation or a cost, if it's something they can live with, although they shouldn't have to, they are reluctant to tell because they fear the deterioration of the relationship with this agency that has control over their lives. And that probably distresses me more than anything that I have learned in my time working on this regulatory, in the arena of regulation. And I believe that probably covers what I have to say.
Thank you. I have one more witness. Thank you very much for your patience, too, and standing by.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Williver, did you want to testify also on behalf of the court system?
Yeah, hello. My name is Doug Williver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. And I hadn't planned on testifying, but I did just want to clarify why the court asked that the provisions relating to district court be removed from the bill. And I appreciate, Senator, that that you did remove them from the bill. But it had nothing to do with the competency of district court judges. District court judges are just as competent as superior court judges. And as you know, Senator, they routinely sit as superior court judges. You go to Anchorage right now, and you're going to have a case before Superior Court Judge Hunt. You're going to get District Court Judge Joannidis, who will be sitting in as pro tem for 6 months before well, Judge Hunt is gone. They routinely do that. They're just as competent. The difference between the Superior Court and District Court relates to the work that the District Court does as opposed to the work the Superior Court does. A District Court is designed to handle a great body of cases that can be fairly quickly resolved. Misdemeanor cases, small claims cases, civil cases under $50,000. They are not designed to handle, as, you know, some of the examples were, there were, well, one example was raised last, well, 97 in this committee was oil tax regulation. Those don't belong in district court, not because district court judges can't handle them, but because there are no law clerks in district court. They share a secretary typically. And their caseload is designed to move quickly. A typical district court calendar will have arraignments in the morning with a, maybe a small claims case, a domestic violence case in the afternoon, and a forcible entry and detainer action. They move. They have several cases a day. They move through these cases. Other examples are just from today. If you had the, you know, a challenge to a cost-benefit analysis on the Hall Road in district court or to the, you know, the least intrusive regulations that could be challenged in the district court, that's not that same kind of case. That's not the kind of case that gets quickly resolved and then you move on to another one. And that was the court's only concern with the bill. We have no position on the merits of the bill, but these types of cases have always been heard in Superior Court, and we would just prefer that they not end up interfering with the normal case flow in district court. That was our only concern.
Mr. Donnelly, Senator Donnelly.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's kind of the whole point of why it'd be good in district court, to increase public access and to get it done more speedily. I mean, we've been sitting around here for, what, 5-6 months waiting for the Supreme Court to make a decision on campaign finance. We've been waiting for months and months on quite a few of these decisions. It's amazing how long the Supreme Court's taking on these decisions already. So that was kind of the whole point of why it might be good to start, be able to allow the public to start in district court, because if there were some simple questions, which many of these might be very simple questions, they could get resolved quickly. You know, I think a more suggestive comment from the court system would have been to allow them to start in district court, but to have some provision for more complicated cases to be referred by the district court to the superior court. But as it is,
leave the authority with the presiding judge in the district.
Yeah, yeah. But we didn't get that, and I guess I shouldn't have expected that kind of a constructive comment. So
might think about that though, as further amendment or draft as the bill moves through. There's always ways for the court system to adjust the flow of casework. In fact, that's one of the presiding judges and the area court administrator's biggest responsibilities, is to make certain that flow of casework moves.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, we're still waiting for a decision on the final decision on the Bliss case, which dealt with taking things off the ballot and this novel new concept from our Supreme Court that they can modify amendments from the legislature before they go on the ballot for the people, something which we haven't been able to find another court in the history of the United States has ever done so far.
They're certainly venturing into areas no one's been, that's for sure. But on this bill, are there further witnesses here in the room that wish to testify? We didn't have anyone on the teleconference, did we? Okay. I think it's up to the pleasure of the committee, of course. Senator Donnelly, do you want to work on this thing for a while?
I
have
some really
further?
Good suggestions today, and I'd like to keep it here in this committee and to improve on this legislation. I don't think it'll take us very long. I think these are really positive things that we can develop the CS by probably mid or late next week.
We'll leave the timing up to you, Senator Donnelly. You're the sponsor of the bill. When you want to bring it back up, just let us know, and we'll schedule it up for another hearing.
Okay.
Anything further? Thank you all for attending, and thank you for your patience. Especially thank you for the great and candid comments today. I really appreciated that. We're adjourned.